Welcome to the Josh Scanlon Podcast, my friends. We are now on episode 52 of the podcast, and today is Wednesday, June 27th, 2018. I got a great interview for you today. I talked to Inga Kyra, who's a PhD, certified financial planner, assistant professor of finance out of Greater Los Angeles. She founds her own financial planning firm as well called Attainable Wealth, and you can go to attainablewealthfp.com. I'll put a link in the show notes, and I'll just read a little bit of her bio from LinkedIn. PhD in finance with extensive prior teaching industry experience. She doesn't teach finance and financial planning. She does help academics plan their financial lives through attainablewealthfp.com. It's interesting because when I was looking at just doing some research on my book, and I was looking at Amazon because I use the AMS, the Amazon Marketing Services, which is a decent tool. It's okay. It's not nearly as good as Google AdWords or Facebook, but it's still as good. You only have to pay on the click. So you can put 8,000 keywords out there. If no one clicks on it, doesn't cost you a dime. Anyway, I have sold a couple books through that, but I was wondering, how can I make this better? So I was looking at some other books to see how they're writing their copy, their introduction copy. And I came across Inga. Hers was actually the first one that showed up, actually one of the only ones, actually. Had 52 five-star ratings, all verified purchases. And I was like, what the hell? Who is this? B, why does she have so many ratings? I'm thinking, well, I mean, maybe this book's been around for a while. Nope, just published it this year. And I was like, whoa, and all verified purchases. And, you know, all these people actually bought the book and they all actually rated it very highly too. And so I said, I'd like to talk to this lady because she's doing something that I'm not. And so I got a chance to, I looked up Inga. It turns out she's part of the network I'm part of in the financial planning affiliation called XY Financial Planning or Planning Network, XY Planning Network. And we have a lot in common, actually. I said, well, this would be pretty cool. Inga's married to a former Navy pilot, just had their first child. Think about number two, which is always good. And so I was pleased to hear that as well. But it's funny because we got to talking. I was like, oh, my goodness, Inga's my twin from another mother, because she's almost identical to stuff, I think, for the most part. I mean, expenses are the priority for soon-to-be retirees without question. You got to know your expenses, as Inga, you know, says for sure. For younger folks, you know, don't be afraid of money. Money is not evil or good. It just is. Don't be afraid of it. And then just do a Roth IRA. All that stuff I could not agree more with. And just, oh, man, I just love good, competent financial planners. We need more. And people say, oh, we need more women. I don't care about that. I need good, competent financial planners in the industry. Well, not me, but the industry does and the clients that we serve. Don't care if you're freaking from Mars. If you're a good, competent financial planner, man, we need more of those. And the way to be a good, competent financial planner, you see a piece fine, but it's just your ability to relate to people, my friends. I literally don't care two craps about your technical expertise if you can't relate to people. And Inga actually mentioned that in our pre-discussion before we got on the start recording. One of her classes, she said, all right, here's all the list of financial planners in Los Angeles, you know, their bios. Who would you choose? And she said over and over, the same three or four people would be chosen just consistently. And I said, that's amazing. I love that kind of stuff. And I wish you would do a study on it. She's way too busy. I get that. But man, I would love to do a study on why this guy or that lady was chosen over this guy or that lady or whatever. I find it fascinating. And the thing that jumped out, according to Inga, was that not one time do they say their credentials were the driver. They assume their credentials were high simply because they're part of the network. And I think as financial planners, we get so much caught up. And let me tell you how smart I am. No one gives a crap, my friends. All they care about is Juno they. They assume you're smart if they're coming to your office. Juno them and their situation. That's what matters. Not how smart you are and what you've seen and what you've done and blah, 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 blah. No one cares. Do you know them and their situations? You make them feel comfortable with you. Which is why actually a lot of the insurance guys do well, because they're good salespeople, which means they ask a lot of questions. A lot of financial planning guys aren't doing so well because they're so wrapped around the axle on technical skills that they have forgotten about people skills. And people skills are number one, without question, number one concern. And, you know, Ed Jones, give them another example. Why are some of these guys over Ed Jones so great? Are they because they're so technically adept? Not necessarily. A lot of them just good with people. Not all of them, but a lot of them are. And the ones that are going to get rewarded with business. It's just that simple. And I don't care what line of work you're in. It's just in financial planning. We have this tendency to have a bunch of smartest people in the room. I mean, just ask them and they'll tell you, but they can't do business because they turn people off. And it's just not good. It's too bad. So I love talking to Inga. It's fantastic. I also an immigrant came over from Eastern Europe, Moldova. I forgot how you say it, but very interesting. She said her native country is the least happy in the world. That's unfortunate. And now Inga was a little bit too young to be raised under the Iron Curtain. Her mom was, and her mom is now a high school counselor in Florida. Man, I just love to hear stories of what they went through under communism, because in the U.S., I hate to say it, but we got a bunch of spoiled brats. We don't know how good we have it, which is too bad because, man, we are living large, even in today's day and age. Now, it's not nearly as bad now as it was for, you know, when the commies were running Eastern Europe and, you know, Russia and whatnot. But still, at the end of the day, we here in the U.S. are living large compared to the rest of the world. That's just a fact. And the fact that we take this for granted or even spit on just ticks me off. And having someone like Inga kind of share a little bit of the story about her mom was a Peace Corps volunteer would go over the world and bring home candy. And Inga's like, whoa, candy. This one, she said she was 6 or 7. When, you know, back then it was a scarce item. And yet in the United States, you go to any store and you can pick up all the candy you want. One of the reasons probably why we're so doggone overweight. But I just think those stories like that are fascinating. And I think we do ourselves a disservice by not listening to them. Not saying that America's perfect, but we're the best country that ever existed without question. It's not even debatable to me. The level of your capacity here is unmatched, unparalleled by any in the world ever in the history of mankind. It's just a wonderful place. And unfortunately, it does, I think, a lot of times take an immigrant to come here and set the world on fire to realize that, man, we got it pretty good here. What are we doing? Why are we sitting on our butts? Why are we sitting resting on our laurels? We can't do that in the United States. And I just love the story of immigrants who come here and kick butt and take names. I'm a fan of it. I love the fact that Inga's mom, I think her dad's still alive. She didn't, I don't know. But anyway, her folks are here. I think her dad is, but I'm not sure. We didn't talk about that, but her mom certainly is. And I just think it's great. I think it's worldly, as a humane, human story is wonderful. I would love to hear her mom's eyes, what she went through into the communism. And I'd love to hear how they come to the United States. Probably can't speak English. I don't know if they can or not. Inga can, but certainly other people can't when they come here. And they still kick butt and take names. It's freaking awesome. I love it. And also the fact that Inga's sitting there kicking butt and taking names for financial planning, writing this book that's got 52 reviews, and she just wrote it. Now, my only concern is, I was like, Inga, you got to do more YouTube channels, because as I told Liz Hand when I interviewed her, and I forgot her website, but Liz Hand is on YouTube. You go to youtube.com/Liz Hand and you'll find her, a younger lady out of Ohio, Canton, Ohio. I said the issue is we're ceding a lot of the ground to the salesmen in financial planning. So if you type in tax-free retirement, you're going to get tons of insurance guys telling you about annuities and whatnot. And it's too bad, because I know the financial planning industry is heavily regulated, but man, we're so regulated that no one can hear the other side of the story, and that's not good. So I was trying to encourage Inga to continue on with YouTube channels, because, again, YouTube is the second largest searched engine in the world behind Google, and Google also happens to own YouTube. Huh? So the facts are there's still a lot of traffic going through YouTube. If we're ceding that ground to just life insurance salesmen, that's not good. So anyway, I hope you enjoyed the episode. Again, I won't do a song of the day. Don't do songs of the day when I do interviews. But if you have, you know, folks you want me to interview, I just like to interview people of interest to me, folks. It doesn't have to be financial planning related. I just find Inga interesting and fascinating. I love the fact that she's married to a veteran as well. That's cool. But even if she weren't, I still find it fascinating. So hope you like this. As always, don't forget to go to the heritagewealthplanning.com. Heritagewealthplanning.com is the podcast, the blog posts, the videos. You can go to YouTube, youtube.com/heritagewealthplanning. I think I got over 150 videos on there now. So go there as well. And just feedback is always welcome. So enjoy the episode with Inga. And we'll see you next time on the Josh Gandler podcast. Thanks, guys. Folks, this is Josh. And I got a great and exciting interview today with Inga. Well, how do you say your last name? Chira, Inga?
No, it's actually Kira, like chemistry.
Okay, Kira. Okay. And how I came across Inga is that I had written a book that I published, I'd say, back towards the end of March or beginning of April, when I was looking on Amazon on financial planning. And I was looking on Amazon to see my book and how it was, you know, in terms of what other competition was coming up. And Inga's book came up, and I haven't read it yet, frankly. And that's one thing I do want to dive into in this interview. But it was very interesting to me because Inga's actually part of the same group I'm a part of. It's called XY Planning Network. And she's in California, and I just want to talk to her because I thought it was actually fascinating, A, how she got her book, B, how she got so many positive reviews, C, but more of a personal level, like what she sees for financial planning for folks out there, because the old days of doing financial planning are coming to an end, not as quickly as I wish, but still. And I think there's a lot of great people in XY Planning Network, the Garrett Financial Planning Network, NAPFA, all these various affiliates that the good financial planners are, that any way we can wave the flag for good financial planning, I think is beneficial to the whole country as a whole. So welcome aboard, Inga. I absolutely appreciate it. I am very, very excited to talk to you here today.
I'm very happy to be here, Josh.
Inga, first of all, tell us, if you don't mind, just tell us a little bit about yourself, who you are, how you got started, and the whole thing. It's the mic is yours.
All right. So I was actually born in Eastern Europe, and I came to the U.S. in high school, and I never left. I went to college here. I did my MBA here, did my PhD here, and I decided to just remain and stay here and build a life in finance here. I am not originally from the financial planning world. I came from the corporate finance side, and after years of doing that, I got bored and wanted something else. I wanted to talk to people and help people. So I stumbled across financial planning and said, oh, this sounds like a good idea. Let me go and get a CFP. So I went and challenged the exam, got my CFP, and since then I've been doing this. So it's been years now I've been doing financial planning, but I also do corporate finance. I teach corporate finance. So I do a little bit of both.
But you teach corporate finance on as like a side gig in your financial?
No, actually, that's my full-time job. I'm a college professor on the tenure track. That's my full-time job. So I run a financial planning program now at Cal State Northridge. But on the side, I have a small practice with about 35 clients and probably take another 15, 20, and that's it. So I'll always be a college professor with clients I really like.
Okay, fantastic. So that's your bread and butter, being a college professor, but you're able to offer financial planning services to exclusive select few too.
Yeah, I do this mostly because I teach the capstone course in financial planning. So I find that having a practice is really, really helpful with teaching those courses.
That's fantastic, Inga. I did not gather that. So that's wonderful. So, but I got back up a little bit. So Eastern Europe, what country in Eastern Europe? Estonia or something like that?
No, I'm from Moldova. And if you don't know about Moldova, there is a book called The Geography of Bliss about the happiest and the saddest places on Earth. And Moldova is the most unhappy place on this planet. So
unhappy.
So a lot of Moldovans, about 25% of people, live abroad.
Really?
Yes. It's a post-Soviet country where people are not very friendly and not very happy.
Is it still run by a communist kind of government, or is it
it's still a communist type government, but it's not the type of communist you're thinking about. It's just like any other post-communist corrupt society now.
Kind of like a Hugo Chavez in Venezuela type of communism, I imagine.
Yeah, I don't really know much because I left a long time ago, and now that my parents live here as well, so I don't really go out much.
Did you come here before your folks did, or?
Yeah,
or?
I came in my high school as a senior in high school as an exchange student. And then I was like, I like it here, so I'm just going to go to college here and stay here.
And did Moldova, do they allow that to happen, or do they?
Yeah. You can come and go as you please since 1989. So
it was after then. Okay. I'm curious because in the NHL, there was a hockey player named Alexander Mogilny who fled from Eastern Europe, and he played for the Buffalo Sabres. And long story short, he just never went back, and he was always under pressure to go back, and his number, I think, was 89, because that was the year that, I can't remember, but 81, something like that. That was the year he defected. So that's interesting. And then your folks are still there, but you just said, I'm staying here. It is just you, or are you?
No, I came, and then my sister came, and then my parents moved here maybe 4 years ago. So yeah, everybody is here. I mean, I still have one grandmother in Moldova, but we are all pretty much in the U.S. now.
Yeah. And you never go back that much, is because okay, that's fantastic. That's interesting as heck. So when you're here, you're going to college, and what were you thinking about? I'm just curious what you thought about like the U.S. compared to where you were from. Were you like, man, it's, you know, the land of milk and honey, or are you like, this is, I just, it's got to be a pretty big difference from a, you know, Eastern, you know, communist bloc country coming here, right? I mean,
yeah, but by the time I came, I came in 99, so the communist was gone for 10 years. So you could buy Milky Way bars here and there. So it wasn't as exciting as back in 91 when the borders just opened.
Were you, how old were you in 91 when the border just opened?
When everything fell apart, I was about 6 or 7.
Okay.
So,
okay.
And my mother was working for the Peace Corps, so she was always leaving and coming back. So I remember the first time she came back with like candy. I'm like, wow, this exists in the world. This is awesome.
No kidding. Yeah, that's yeah. All right. Well, that's of interest to me. I've always been fascinated just by how good we have it here in the United States, and a lot of us take it for granted. But anyway, we'll leave that for a different interview. All right. So you're in college. You're saying to yourself, what am I going to do? You know what I'm saying? What made you, did you already right then know to study finance, or what were you doing before that? Or how did you get in the finance realm? What made you go that route?
Well, where I'm coming from, where I went to school, you kind of specialize really early on. By the time you're in high school, the path is already set. You don't go to college to explore. So I knew I was going to go into business, some sort of business. Okay. I just didn't know what type. I started studying international business, and then I realized it's kind of general, so you need more specific skills. My accounting professor was trying to convince me to become an accountant, and then I looked at it and said, nah, it doesn't sound exciting, so I think I'll do finance. And then just because two majors is never enough, we also did marketing on top of that. So I did all three, and then I realized that the money is in finance. So, and I like money, so I said, I'm going to go and work in finance.
Gotcha. So when did you get your PhD? That's a big deal.
That was later. So I did finish my undergrad. I started working for a subdivision of Citigroup. Okay. And they said, like, if you're not doing an MBA, we'll pay for it. I'm like, sure, you're paying for my MBA. I'll do it at night. So I did my MBA, worked for them for about 5 years. And then the school where I did my undergrad called me out of the blue and said, do you want to teach for us? I'm like, sure. It sounds like a pretty good deal for 3 days a week and that much money you're going to pay me.
No kidding.
So I went there for 2 years. I did it full time. So, yep, I like this, but to be a college professor, like really be a college professor, you need to have a PhD. So right. I had to quit working and go and get my PhD.
And you were working full time getting your PhD, maybe a graduate assistant or something like that too.
Yeah, you have to. Yeah, you have to do it right. Like it's really hard to go to a legitimate PhD program and really have a job on the side. So I used to like have little jobs, like teaching GRE and GMAT courses, for example. But you can't maintain your regular job, so I had to quit my Citigroup. I had to quit my teaching job and just go and become a graduate assistant for the 4 years I was a PhD student.
Now, you're married with at least one child, at least according to your website. So, and I know your child's young. So, were you married at that point, Inga? Or
yeah, I was married. I didn't have any kids, but I was married. So, we had to move to South Florida for my PhD. My husband has a pretty flexible job, though, so he can move. So, we moved to the South Florida, and we stayed there for the PhD. And once you graduate as a college professor, there's no jobs where you went to school. So, you got to move again. So I interviewed and I found the job I wanted to take was in Oregon. So we moved to Oregon for my job.
Okay, gotcha. And your husband had a flexible enough job to follow you along.
Yeah, so he found the closest job he could find to Oregon was in LA, in Los Angeles. So we decided afterwards for me to take a job here when this position opened at CSUN because it was a perfect college professor job that I wanted to do. So we moved to Los Angeles together about 3 years ago.
So now on one of your blog posts, you say your mom's a high school counselor. So she's still in Florida or?
Yeah, she is. Okay. She's in the Florida system, so she'll be there until retirement.
Interesting. So a high school counselor, she must. Now, the only reason I ask is we have four kids and our first is going off to Georgia Tech next year, just coming up here. And long story short, some of these high school counselors, I wish they had a little bit more experience. So I imagine your mom's got a pretty good experience and a pretty good chops to guide people in terms of educational, you know, attainment in you know, post-sec or a secondary school and whatnot, right?
Yeah, she's been doing this for 30, 40 years, and she works at the best school, in the public school now in the county. It's one of those STEM programs. So most of her kids go to like Harvard and Yale and those schools. And it's a different type of environment.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially if especially instead of going to Florida State or something like that. Yeah. All right, so we'll switch gears a little bit and just go back to financial planning. So what made you decide to start your own? I know you said you liked it. It was a little bit interesting, but well, if you like it so much, how come you're not going to do it, you know, like quit your professor job and go to financial planning? I don't mean that accused, I'm just wondering what's the, just because you have such a good job you enjoy that you feel you can juggle both or what, if you don't mind me asking that? Does that make
sense? It's a combination, because I thought about like what would it take to just be a financial planner and do this full time. I still do it full time right now because the college professor job is so flexible.
Yeah, right.
But one of the reasons I don't want to do it is because I still like to do research and I still like to teach. So I feel like if I gave that part of my life, I wouldn't get the same from the financial planning. Plus, a lot of the financial planning I do is supplemental to the teaching I do. So it really complements each other. So it came down to like, I like doing both. I don't want to choose one over the other. And as long as I can do both, I will continue doing it.
Well, the interesting thing, folks, before Inge and I started this recording this, she was telling me about a research project she was doing with her students. Would you mind talking about that? I find this actually fascinating. Would you mind talking about that?
Sure. Like I teach a personal finance course. So one of the assignments I started doing last spring was sending them to the XYPN website to look for an advisor, for a financial planner, and then tell me why they chose a specific person. And now I've been reading these answers for about 3 semesters, and they all come down to the exact same 2 things. People prefer somebody who's around them. So a lot of people choose Los Angeles planners just because they're close by. And then the other reason is because something on the profile appeals to the person and the descriptive on the descriptive level. So it really doesn't say anything extra about financial planning or qualifications. It's more about how the description makes them feel. Yeah, so I find this very interesting because the same people come on top and it's like they must have done something right to attract so many positive reviews.
Is there any way at some point, I don't know if you can do this or not, I don't know, but would you be able to, it'd be wonderful if you could write like a white paper or some kind of research project on that, because I just find that fascinating, actually.
Well, I actually posted in the XYPN forum at one point, like the responses from one semester from the first one I did, so we can dig those out just to see. But I'll think about it. The type of college papers they want me to write are different.
Yeah, no,
so this will have to be like a side project.
The reason I say it is because in financial planning, one of the things that just has always driven me crazy is about financial planners and advisors, whatever we call ourselves today, is, you know, let me tell you how smart I am, as opposed to what is that you're trying to solve, Mr. and Mrs. Client. And I just, I've seen people just spit out, you know, their qualifications left and right, and you can just see it just going over the head of their prospects or clients. And I don't think it does our industry any good. Just I've been in this business a long time, and I just know, Inge, like you talk to some of these estate planning attorneys, some just speak so high and mighty that their clients won't ever do anything because they feel like they've been talked down to. And that's just bad. It's just not good for financial planning. And I just wish some of these folks would just bring it down to earth a little bit so regular people can understand. You know what I'm saying?
Ugh. I agree. If your grandma doesn't understand, it's no
good. Oh, like that's that's a great way to put it. If your grandma doesn't understand, you're not getting anything done. That's for sure. And I mean, I've been like that. We've all made mistakes, but one of the reasons I love the XYPN or XY Planning Network is, you know, their ability to bring on a different, look to financial planning. You know what I'm saying? Like, where people like you, as a matter of fact, I mean, you would not be able to do this, what you're doing, if you had to be aligned with a brokerage firm.
Exactly. No, I looked into it when I first moved to LA. I was looking, what's the best way to do this? And I met with a few RIA firms. I talked to some broker dealers and was like, there is no way I can be under that big umbrella. Like, nobody will be able to allow me to do whatever I want to do.
Now, so tell us a little bit about your book. I'm curious, and I got lots of questions. So, I mean, if I'm not organized, it's just the nature of my question. I'm just curious. So you wrote this book. What was the premises of that, or the was not the premise, the impetus is the word I'm looking for to get that done. You've got all kinds of reviews. So tell us about how you got that book going, if you don't mind, Inga.
Well, I started teaching personal finance courses about 2 years ago. That was just part of my assignment, teaching assignment. And we all have to use the same textbook. And there's not much control I have over that. And then I noticed that the textbooks, most finance textbooks, are very boring.
Yeah.
And even personal finance ones are so boring, nobody wants to read them. So people don't learn much. They just take the exams and move on and don't retain much. So I was looking in the market for what else can I supplement with that's easy to read, it's short, and it's exactly what people get excited about. So I found a few books. I used a few of them in the first two or three semesters. And then I found myself writing supplements to the book, to the extra book. So like I would spend like 2-3 hours writing, here's my take on this. And then I said, like, why don't I just go and write this book and just give it to my students as part, along with their textbook, to understand the material better. So this is why I did it, to help me in my personal finance courses.
Gotcha.
And then somebody told me, well, what, sell it on Amazon too if you already read it. I'm like, sure, it sounds like a great idea. Let's sell it. And then people just started buying it. I'm like, okay, somebody wants to read it.
So you it sounds like you didn't do much marketing. It just kind of happened.
Oh, yeah, I did not do any marketing. I mean, that's it. I just use it in my courses, and then other people buy it on Amazon, and that's how it is.
Now, is the book available in not hard copy, but, you know.
In paperback?
Yeah, that's where it was.
Yeah, you can buy the paperback if you want. I prefer the Kindle, but you can buy the paperback and Amazon will fulfill it. So okay. I don't really get involved.
All right, no, gotcha. But you have it on both models, Kindle and paperback as well.
Yeah, and that's mostly because I only read on Kindle, so I assume everybody else does the same. But apparently, no, some people still like books.
Well, I do. I have Kindle, but in terms of Kindle is great for fiction. For nonfiction, I need to have the hard copy. Hey, so let me ask you a question. Just in terms of the mechanics of that, did you have any issues with Kindle, KDP, Amazon KDP? I forgot what they call that anymore. Kindle. What's KDP? I forgot. But did you have any issues with getting that out there published, ISBN? I mean, just in terms of the grunt work that went into getting your book published.
Got lucky because I got involved with this company, Canadian company called a self-publishing agency.
Yeah, okay.
And they walked me pretty well through the steps. And then they also put me in touch with the best editor I could imagine because she happened to be a Canadian financial planner who just does this on the side. And she's like, she actually understands what I'm writing. It's not some lady who never read the finance book. So she helped me with the editing. And then Megan, who runs the self-publishing agency, just told me the steps how to self-publish it. So it was really not that hard.
That's fantastic. Now, here's the name of the book, folks. I'll put a link in the show notes. It's Mastering Money, A Simple Guide to Achieving Financial Success. Hey, Inga, if you don't mind, how'd you get the cover? Did you do that or?
No, I went to, what's that website where you pay like a few dollars and people
like
design it.
Yeah,
it's in Fiverr. So I probably like, I don't know, maybe spend $100 on the design total.
Okay.
So it was really not, I didn't know, I was like, I don't want something. They all look the same. They all have some money on the top of them. They all have the same topics.
Yeah.
So you really won't get much from the cover. And to me, it wasn't a big deal.
So I'm looking right now and you have 52 reviews, all 5 stars. So Inga, there's obviously a niche here for you to step. And I'm not telling you what I'm doing. I'm just saying you're obviously appealing to somebody because you haven't done any marketing. I'm seeing all these verified purchases. I mean, you're kicking butt and taking names here. It just seems to me that you're filling a gap that no one else is. And I just think it's wonderful. And I just hope you continue to do that because
thank you. I read a lot of finance books. If it's on the market, I'm going to read it. And I noticed they're very similar to each other. And I only had 2 goals, make it very approachable and give a lot of personal examples so people can actually relate.
Yeah.
Because I don't read another Susan Orman book that says the same thing. And then make it very short because a lot of these books are 300-500 pages long for no reason.
Right.
And a lot of them avoid opinions for some. I mean, I understand why they do it, but at the end of the day, somebody wants my personal opinion. This is what you're paying for. So here's what I would do in this situation. And the book is written around that.
Well, if you look at if you get a chance, folks, to go to Inga's website, which I just had in Attainable Wealth, it's attainablewealthfp.com. And again, I'll put a link in the show notes. If you read her blog posts, and this is another reason I wanted to get Inga on the horn here, because it's not your typical, I hate to say this, Inga, don't take this wrong, for people in our industry, it's just boring. A lot of financial planners, their blog posts, I just want to drop an anvil on my head. And Inga's is not like that, actually. It's very interesting. She talked about, sign up for a triathlon. In fact, I thought that was very interesting. And she shared her, quote unquote, failure of not getting it done. The lessons we can learn from personal financial planning regarding you as an individual human being are just mind boggling. And I appreciate, Inga, that you write like that, because I just find that a lot of financial planners don't. And I wish they would, because I think those personal experiences and personal lessons that we all have can really, really make a difference in people's lives, if that makes sense.
Thank you.
And so I imagine if the book is like that, that's why you have so many reviews, because you actually have some opinions and probably some personal anecdotes, if not outright stories as well, I presume. Again, I haven't read it. I'm ignorant on it, but
I'll send it to you. I'll send it to you. So you can read it in 3 hours.
Oh, that's fantastic. All right, good. So, and the only thing I'd say is, Inga, if I know you got a child and, another job and a husband and everything, but man, you're obviously filling a gap that a lot of people are not. I just, if you can think of other stuff to write that can get people off the, to do better financial planning. One thing I did want to ask you on is you talk about paying off debt is not a good idea. And I might be paraphrasing that. Go into that a little bit, because that kind of goes against some of my thinking. And that doesn't mean I'm right and you're wrong. You're right, I'm wrong. I'm just curious, what's your thoughts on paying off debt is not necessarily a good idea?
This is a pretty controversial topic. And I actually had a whole chapter on that, just because people always ask.
Yep.
Financially, it doesn't always make sense. I mean, especially in today's environment where most people have cheap mortgages, cheap cars, it's really, really hard to justify paying a 1.9% car loan.
Yes.
When you can go and make 1.7% right now in a high-yield savings account. So it's really financial. I have some calculations. It doesn't make sense. But at the same time, with that being said, it doesn't mean that people don't do it. I mean, my husband doesn't like that.
Right.
And no matter how much I try to postpone paying off my student loans, because they were at a very low interest rate and didn't make any sense to pay them off, I could have invested that money and done something better with it.
Right.
He couldn't sleep at night. So we paid off my loans in December just because it makes everybody happy. But financially, like if you have cheap debt, you can take the money, you can invest the money, and even if you have a pretty low return, long term, you're still better off than prepaying that mortgage.
Understood. Do you think, I guess my question that, and I'm playing devil's advocate here, is how many people are actually going to sit tight when the market gets chaotic while they still have that mortgage? And it's completely a theoretical question, but my issue on that is just, man, so many people, they see that mortgage out there and they see the markets falling, then they pull the money out of the markets at the worst possible time.
Ah! Yep. And that's one of the things, like one of the notes we have to make. You cannot pull the money out. You have to get yourself a financial advisor who will stop you doing this.
Yeah.
And then the other thing, number two note is, are you really going to save this money if you don't pay the mortgage? Or are you going to waste it?
Yeah.
So if you have the discipline and you don't pull it off, then it's better off. But if you know yourself better, I have clients who, no matter how much I tell them what to do, they will spend the money. So they are better off paying off their mortgages.
Man, I could not agree with that more. I absolutely think that's actually profound what you just said there. And from personal experience as well as my own professional experience, everyone says, buy term and invest the rest. And, I completely agree that. It's the question is, are you actually going to invest the rest, or are you going to invest the rest on going to, Starbucks every morning and eating 10 more donuts or whatever? I mean, I don't know what it is, but I completely agree with that assessment. If you can, folks, if you can pay off your mortgage, or discipline yourself, I should say, to not pay off your mortgage and instead actually put the money away. Well, doggone, you should do that. Just like Inga was saying, if you're paying 3% net, it's not even debatable to me. But the question is, how many people are actually going to do that? And unfortunately, I do think that's where a financial advisor can come in, as long as you feel that the financial advisor is serving your interests and not their own bottom line. And that's where an issue I think our industry has actually gone awry in a lot of ways. What do you think with our industry 5 years, 10 years from now, Inga? So right now, everyone, their mom manages money for a fee, and that's fine. And, you know, 10 years ago, most people are managing money for a commission. Now we've gone to the managing money for a fee. Where do you think we're going to be 10 years in terms of the financial planning industry, how we get compensated, whatnot? Any thoughts on that?
I hope it's going to go more towards the XY model, where you're paying an hourly rate, you're paying a flat fee, you're getting a financial plan, you're paying monthly, so you can actually talk to people constantly. But I'm not as optimistic as other people. I don't think the AUM is going away anytime soon. It's just I hope there are enough people to bring the other models up to give some diversity. I think it'll be like 30 years before we see real change.
Are you witnessing that in your own planning profession, that a lot of your clients or prospects, when you tell them about, you know, retainer fee, are like, oh, that's crazy? Or what is that, something you're seeing, or what do you think?
I don't see that personally, just because by the time they get to me, they know exactly what I cost. They see it on the website. Yeah. So if they call me, they already have an expectation. But I see it with people who have no knowledge about the industry. When I tell them how things work, they're pretty shocked.
Yeah, no,
And you know, my fees are not cheap. So when I tell somebody, like, yeah, I charge it for a plan between $3,000 and $4,000, they're like, really, that much? I'm like, yeah, but you're paying an estate lawyer $3,000 for way less work, right, in many cases.
That's a great way to look at it. You know, that estate planning attorney, 95% of the people aren't going to do anything.
A great point. I actually did my own estate plan recently after we had the baby, and I remember being so confused by what I got back, thinking, I'm supposed to know this, and I'm still confused. What does somebody else do who has no knowledge of this?
Oh, man.
She just handed me a binder and said, here you go.
Yeah. Oh, so you actually hired a person, or you did?
No, I hired somebody to do it for me, for my family. So I went through the whole process just because I wanted to see what the clients go through as well. So I'm like, we just had a baby, let's update the whole thing. I'm like, don't think so. So then it's really easy to justify how my $3,000 fee is going to give you more value.
How did you, I'm just curious, how did you identify the attorney to draw up your documents?
We're always looking for referrals, because that's one of the things all the clients ask me, who do I go to? Yeah. So I interviewed a few different people, and it has to be a local person for that type of stuff, or somebody close. And I interviewed a few people around here, and her fees were reasonable, and she was good enough, let's say, for what I needed. So, but I'm constantly looking for somebody else, and I found somebody amazing, but her fees are $7,000. I'm like, people can't really afford that. So I convinced my sister-in-law, who is practicing in Utah, to take the California bar next month, so she can become an estate planning attorney and help me out.
Yeah. What's her thoughts on that?
She said, sure. She went to school here, so she's very familiar with the California law. So she's like, okay, I'll do that. I'm like, why not? Because
she's
already registered, so she's already practicing. It's just not in California, so she's like, I can take the exam and extend to one more state.
I tell you, one area that we are lacking is a good quality estate planning attorneys across the board. My sister is a master's degree in financial planning, CFP, up in New Jersey, and she's the same thing. Like, she goes, man, there's just not that many. They're few and far between. There's just not that many. So if there's any folks out there who are good with people, know how to relate to people in a way that common sense would indicate, like what Inga was saying, that your grandma can understand, you can have a pretty good career as an estate planning attorney if you can do that, that's for sure.
Yeah, especially if you need some basic plan, because I can find somebody really, really good at the higher end. But most clients don't need complicated plans. They want the basic set of documents, and for those things you shouldn't be paying $3,000-$4,000.
No, completely agree. Absolutely, 100% agree. We have a lady who I work with, actually the lady was just calling me, she does actually will do everything, including putting your house in your trust and all that stuff. You're making sure everything gets retitled, making sure your beneficiary designations. And I told her, man, that is, of all the attorneys I've talked to, very, very you will do all that stuff to make sure it gets done. And I mean, she costs a little bit more, but we're not talking hundreds of thousands of bucks. I said, for someone who needs to get their estate docs done and wants to make sure they actually get done, that's a couple extra $100. That's well worth it. That's
for sure. Yeah. If I can find somebody for $1,000, they're getting my referrals all day long.
Oh yeah. Especially if they know what the heck they're doing. They know how to talk to people, for sure. All right. So I had an issue with a client, a prospect who same kind of thing. They didn't see the value on repaying a retainer fee. And folks, retainer fee just means like a monthly commitment, essentially. You know, what we try to do in the XY Planning Network, at least apparently I'll speak on your behalf, Inga, is, you know, say, look, I'm going to charge you $250 a month or $3,000 a year, whatever it's going to be. I have had some pushback on that myself. And that's, it is kind of frustrating because you know that you're going to save the person just ample times of what they spend, but everyone is such a foreign engagement for this line of work that people unfortunately think they can get financial planning for free. And it's just not happening. In fact, I was going to ask you, what do you see just in your experience, Inga, in terms of the financial planning that is out there right now? I mean, it's almost like estate planning attorneys. There's some, you know, there's some good, but there's some that's real bad too. So what are you seeing in terms of, you know, financial planning capabilities, but also just ability to relate to people? Are we getting better as an industry with that? Is it just kind of, you know, not happening? What do you see? Does that make sense what I'm asking you?
Yes. And I see, I mean, from my perspective, I see better things just because I see all these students who are now becoming financial planners. And one of the reasons I don't want to give up teaching is because I have control of 50 students every semester who are going to become financial planners, and I can indoctrinate them with what I think is right before they go into the world. It's way more efficient than changing one client's behavior. My students have a fee but only bias, and that's because I chose to run it this way. But they still go to all kinds of institutions, and I see the different models. They go to broker dealers, they go to insurance companies, and I see the different ways they get taught to do financial planning. There's a very wide range of capabilities and real financial planning versus pretend financial planning. It's still there.
Going back to your mom, I'll just use her for example. So, and I'm just, you don't have to say specifically what she's going through, but let's just say it's a person who's still on the latter years of their working time. So they're looking at retirement and all that. Like, what is some of the stuff that, and just speak on her behalf, you don't have to talk about her specifically, that she sees, and just, you know, the average lady out there, or a guy who's, you know, say 60 years old looking at retirement, what are some of the things that you'd be telling them to do that maybe they're not seeing when they talk to another financial advisor? You would say, hey, these are things you got to be doing just to make sure your stuff is squared away. Anything jump out at you there?
I think it comes to a very simple thing. You have to figure out how much money you need to live on, because now you're close to retirement. So we don't have to project 20 years into the future. We can figure out what your basic expenses are and figure out where the money is going to come from. Because a lot of people retire and then they just hope somehow the Social Security and pension, if there is one, or the 401k that's almost non-existent, is just going to cover it. And once they realize, like, oh, I'm going to be $3,000 short, we have to come up with a solution to that. And in many cases, the solution is we are going to move to Louisiana or to South America and solve it that way. And that's legitimately how we solve some of these problems, because there is no way you can afford to live here on the income you currently have. But I think without realizing how much money you need and how much you're actually going to have, it's really hard to even imagine the retirement, let alone plan it.
Man, I could not agree with that more. And again, I think it goes back to our industry as a whole. We just say, hey, you got $100,000, you can spend $4,000 a year off that without running out of money. Well, that's not the answer to the question. The question is, how much does she need to retire to begin with? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. How much do you need to pay your basic expenses? And then how much do you think you'll need to actually be a little happier? So let's see how many years that will cover. Now, my mom thinks I'm going to take care of her, so she doesn't care. But most people need to figure it out.
What do you think about the idea that the financial planning software we use inflates retirees' expenses each and every year until the day they die? Any thoughts on that? Because I can't.
It drives me crazy. Okay. Yeah, because it's not really true. So, I mean, I have all this software, so I do use Right Capital and Money Guide Pro for myself, but I don't really incorporate much of it into my plans. Just because I really don't think it's very useful, unless somebody specifically wants to see some projections and simulations, and that's one out of 100 clients, I just say, okay, we're going to rough it up at $7,000 per month, and let's go with that number.
And I noticed on your YouTube video too that you said something I thought was incredibly important. And you said that, you know, basically we've all heard $75,000 or whatever is what you need to be happy on retirement. And you challenged that to some regard. I'm curious if, you know, what you're, and I'm just curious what you're thinking there in terms of like, hey, that may or may not be true.
Well, I don't know what the real estate prices are in your area, but I'm pretty sure they're not what I'm paying for rent and mortgages. So when you're living in Los Angeles, your 30% goes to your income is not realistic, because my townhome, it costs pretty much as half of the town where you live in. So it's really, really hard to say $75,000. I mean, when your a basic place starts at $450,000-$500,000 here. So it's $75,000 won't get me anywhere. Let's just say that. So the cost of living is really, really important. And that's one of the reasons I tell everybody, why are you living in Los Angeles? I mean, there's no reason anybody should live here unless you're stuck here for a specific reason. That's it. If you're living in middle of nowhere, Ohio, it's a different story. 60 may be enough.
Yeah, man. That's, again, music to my ears. The same kind of thing goes with the life expectancy. We always hear all the time and go, oh, so I'm only going to live till I'm 78. I'm like, no, that's not true. That's for a baby born today. If you're 65 today, you're going to live beyond your 78 years old. So again, another one of these things where just these assumptions that get put into the vernacular, everyone just falls along with. Like, I need $75,000 a year in income because that's the average for whatever. And on top of that, I'm only going to live till I'm 78. So I should, drives me crazy.
I didn't really hear the 78 yet, because most people I work with are kind of still in their 40s and 50s. So they think they're going to live to 100.
But
I did have a fight with a client last week because she only wanted me to plan to 75. Yeah. So there is some like, I'll do it. I think it's wrong, but I'll do it if that's what you really want.
How do you, you can make a water horse drink, but how do you, you know, tell somebody like, that's just not realistic because it's just not.
This was one of those cases where I did tell her, yes, you can be just fine until 75. And here's an extra projection for you if you're going to live to 90. I did cut and paste the right capital.
Okay.
Red bars all the way from 76 to 90.
What do you feel about Social Security? I mean, any thoughts on your clients or folks you talk to about when they should take Social Security?
Oh, if you don't, I mean, unless you know you're dying or there's some reason you won't make it to like 80 or so, you take it at 70, because nobody else can guarantee that extra return for those 3 years, no matter what you do. I don't think Social Security is going anywhere. I'm not as pessimistic as some people are about it. I do think it's going to change. The retirement age will become 70 by the time I retire, but otherwise I think it's staying around and it's going to be just fine.
Inga, you're like my twin, because that's exactly my thoughts precisely. In fact, I was getting a debate on YouTube about that. I said, look, just raise the retirement age to anyone under 50 to 70 years old. Done, and we're good.
We're good for 50 more years. Yeah, and it's going to happen. It's going that way. It's like, I'm going to work until I'm 70 anyway, so it's really not going to affect us.
Right. I mean, the idea that you and I are going to retire at 62 is just silly. And so because
live until 95. So we have 35 years to finance and retirement.
Now, I do these Social Security seminars, and I enjoy it immensely because I love the talk about Social Security. But all these people say, I'm going to die at 78 and Social Security's run out of money. And I say, that's just, both those are simply not true. Social Security is not insolvent. I mean, yeah, changes will need to be made, but even worst case scenario, it's still going to get 70 cents on a dollar, for heaven's sake. So it's not insolvent by any stretch, and you're not going to die at 75 years old. And that's
and if you do, then do you care that you can
have it? Good point. Right, exactly. You're dead. You don't care anymore, so stop. But I get that all the time. And the problem, or I even get worse, Inga, is people say, I don't want to use Social Security in my planning. So that's just dumb, because now we're going to assume you're paying a heck of a lot more taxes than you would be if you actually used Social Security the way it is. Yeah. All right. So just a couple more questions. I know you got other things to do. So you teach college kids and younger folks too. So what is the one thing or two things, it doesn't have to be much, just whatever, that you would tell Inga back in her 20s to be doing differently than you're doing than you did, if anything jumps out at you? You might not have that because you're pretty organized, but if you did, was there any one or two things that jump out?
Well, I would tell everybody to go and put some money in a Roth, because Inga missed that boat. So by the time I realized how good the Roth was, I was above the threshold. Yeah. So I couldn't do that anymore. So that will be the first one, especially when you're young. Nobody's thinking about this. And the other thing is that don't really be scared about money, because a lot of people ignore it and they're feeling like, if I'm not going to think about it, it's just going to go away. And yeah, it's not going to go away. So think about it, figure out what the problems are, and let's fix them, because now is better than tomorrow.
Absolutely. I completely agree with that again, 100%. The Roth IRA is absolutely someone's best friend, that's for sure. How about, again, someone's 60 now? Again, you're saying, you know, basically find your expenses. That's, if you had one thing to recommend to someone in their 60s, that'd be your number one thing, or anything else that jumps out at you?
And the other one is consider other types of retirements, because you can have a very, very nice life in a different country, or at least partial life in a different country for 6 months out of the year, and be able to do much more than you could in the U.S. with just the Social Security. You can take your Social Security and you can retire very comfortable in Ecuador or Panama and have a very comfortable life while you can do this here. So open yourself to other possibilities.
That's interesting. I never much thought about that, but that, you know, that does make a lot of sense. It used to be Honduras was a nice place too, but I guess not so much anymore, and definitely not Nicaragua. It used to be not that long ago Nicaragua was, until Ortega's doing his Sandinista stuff again, so that's bad. But that's fantastic. So two things. The younger folks, Roth IRA, and don't be afraid of money. Roth IRA.
Yeah.
Roth IRA is the best thing since sliced bread. And secondly, for folks who are looking more at retirement, understand your expenses and then look at other aspects of retirement. I just 100% agree with that. I'll tell you, Inga, I've had this happen. It's more than anecdotal for me, but a lot of people have enough money squirreled away that they'll retire early, like I say 60, 61 or two or whatever. And men in particular, and then they don't have anything to do and they get bitter.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like, what do you do like with your time?
Exactly. Yep. And they get bitter, they get overweight, and they get it's just not very happy. They watch a lot. In fact, I was just reading this study from this group out of, who was that? It wasn't Bureau of Labor Statistics. It was a professor out of Toronto, I think. Off the top of my head, I can't remember. But anyway, they did this research and they found out that the number one increase of retirees' time by far and away is just watching TV. And they didn't make this by making it. There's a direct correlation with the number of TV hours you watch and how unhappy you are. And because they're seeing more and more retirees just not being happy. And I don't think it's because they're, you know, sitting there eating ramen noodles all night long. I just think they're watching too much damn TV, pardon my French. And the TV is, the news cycle make anyone negative. You know what I mean?
Yeah. That's right. Yes. I mean, I can't see myself retired and doing nothing. I'm like, how are we going to occupy our day?
Can you imagine sitting there watching TV all day, especially like who you are? I mean, working two jobs, got a kid. Are you going to have any more children, by the way?
Yeah, we are going to have a second kid for sure. Yes.
Hey, keep them coming, Inga. Social Security is relying on you. And your husband. Is your husband a veteran? Like, did he fly?
Yeah, he is.
What branch?
He was in the Navy.
No kidding. Did you go to Annapolis?
It was before I met him, but he spent most of his time in Lemoore, in the Fresno, or in Kuwait.
Okay. Did he go to the Naval Academy?
No, he did not. He did not. He actually did something else, and then he became a pilot afterwards, after he got out of the Navy.
Okay. So you must have met him in Florida, I bet, then.
Yeah,
right?
I met him in college, yeah.
That's fantastic. Well, kudos to him for his service. Thank him very much for his service. Lastly, I did want to ask you about your YouTube channel. So I'm looking at it right now. You got a couple videos on there, and I'm wondering why you're not doing more, if they don't mind me asking, because let me just go on a little diatribe here. But I think the YouTube, and this is what I was telling another lady I interviewed as well, who's doing some YouTube, are the good financial planners are ceding the territory to insurance salesmen on YouTube. And I really, really wish more would do like what you're starting to do. So any thoughts on doing more YouTube channels?
I didn't really do, but the only videos I did were to supplement the book. So I tried to summarize the book in one to 5 minutes. For the people who don't really want to read the whole chapter. And then I post them on LinkedIn and somebody told me, I'll post some of them on YouTube. So I started doing it and never really finished. So I probably should go at least copy those 12 videos in there and then put a few more.
So what does that mean? You're going to continue doing more, or what do you think?
Probably. I probably should do another one or two. I mean, people seem to like them. I don't particularly like video. I like to read the stuff, so I never was really interested. But people tell me, yeah, I like to listen to a 5-minute video instead of reading 3 pages. I'm like, okay then.
If I could encourage you, Inga, to do, in fact, you do, you know, college professor, I mean, you're not, you get up in front of people all the time. So I'm just telling you right now, I do a lot. I do probably a YouTube video a day, and I love it. And I just, it's just, there's just not a lot of good information. I'm telling you, it's insurance salesmen and more insurance salesmen and very, very few people, good financial planners. So that's why man, if you could just do some more, you don't have to do one a day. I mean, heck, one a month.
Oh, yeah, that's not happening. I made the one a month, you know.
Yeah, but you should, because you got all kinds of stuff up there that needs to be out there in a different media than just a book. Look, I'm just telling you what to do.
I agree. I think it's a good suggestion. Okay, I'm going to go and do it, I promise.
And if you do it, just make sure you put a little note in there, like almost like a mini blog post of 200 words. So I'm looking at one right now and you got no notes in there. So just make sure that way, you know, people can actually, Google will send this out, a search engine optimization, if you have notes in there in terms of like just a mini blog post. So description, if you will, make sure you do that as well. So to make it get out there better, if you would, because that works. It works like a charm for sure. All right. So Inga, tell us your website. If people want to get a hold, I know you said, you know, you're not taking a huge amount of clients on, but you're still taking some clients on. So, you know, I don't know if they'll be listening to this podcast or whatever, but who is it that you're looking for and how can they find you if they do want to talk?
So my favorite client, my ideal client is somebody who has a PhD and either works in the industry or is an academic. Is trying to figure out in their, let's say, 30s to 50s, trying to figure out what do we do with all these benefits we get in retirement and getting my life together. That's my ideal client. That 45-year-old woman PhD. That would be ideal.
And who's in academia right now?
Well, either academia or they can be in the industry, but they have the background and we have something in common where I can help them, not just in their finances, but in general in their life.
Okay. Gotcha. Fantastic. Fantastic. So that's very precise, which is wonderful. So if you're a 45-year-old woman PhD, it's going to be awful hard to beat Inga. That's for sure. In terms of your knowledge set and your ability to help that person for sure. Where can they find you?
The best place is probably LinkedIn and Facebook. So I have a Facebook, I have a personal page, but I also have a business page and also the page for the book, and LinkedIn would be the other place.
So I'm going to put links to the attainablewealthfp.com website, folks. I'm going to put a link to Inga's Amazon book on Amazon. It's only, what, $13 for the hard copy and probably $5 or something like that for Kindle.
Yep,
Yeah, so you just can't beat that. And I'm just telling you, don't ask me. Just ask the folks who've reviewed it for sure, because that's the whole point why I wanted to talk to Inga. All right, that's fantastic, Inga. I tell you, this has been fantastic. I really, really appreciate you being out there doing what you're doing, because I just love good quality financial planners. I enjoy talking to them immensely, and I'm glad you're there for sure. And good luck with your children. You know, one that you have now, and it's going to be a second one. Lastly, you don't know how to swim, huh?
I mean, I know, but I'm not good. I'm definitely not good. I can do it 3 times back and forth in the pool, but that's the end of it. And I took lessons too.
Because at least I said that Inga's on our triathlon. She did post a note on there. She better learn how to swim better or something like that.
I'm not swimming in the. It was the one day of the year where it was raining in Florida and storming. Like, nope, not happening.
Any last thoughts for the crowd here that will listen to this, Inga? Anything that jumps out at you that you want to share?
Just go and figure out your money situation. It's going to be okay no matter what comes out of it. I promise.
No, that's fantastic. Thanks so much. I appreciate your time. Get back to your busy, busy life. And anything that comes up, please let me know. Would you please?
Thanks, Josh. I appreciate it.
See you, Inga. Thank you, ma'am.
Bye. All right.
Bye-bye.
Stop. The podcast you just heard was published with Anchor. Got something you want to say to the creator of this show? Send them a voice message using the Anchor app, free for iOS and Android.